And yeah, and lovely to see some many faces that I know well, but also some faces, people that I've never met before. So I've been a little bit tardy over the last few months. Actually, I've just been really, really busy. And I've missed being on these calls. So it's really lovely to be back with you tonight. Well, tonight for me, whatever time it is for you. As always, we'll just kick off with a quick summary of the articles. I have to say, I was relieved that there was no bonus article, because I find I can usually get through five in an hour, and then that sixth one just throws me completely. So, the first article was the one that was entitled "Your Organization Isn't Designed to Work with Generative AI," by a couple of collaborative authors. And the description that was sent to us is quite involved, but it really boils down to the idea that organizations are not necessarily designed, have not been designed historically to work with generative AI, to integrate generative AI into the way in which we do work. And they just highlighted in the little abstract three very critical concepts. They talked about task analysis, interaction protocols, and feedback loops as essential steps, or essential ingredients in effective design to integrate generative AI into our organizations. The second article was entitled "Business Case for Sustainability: The Stakeholder Perspective." It sounds a little bit like my master's dissertation. It's an article from INSEAD. And it discusses the imperative for businesses to integrate sustainability into their operations, highlighting the growing intersection between business and environmental concerns, particularly climate change. The third article was entitled "How Dynamic Work Design Can Prevent Overload," and it articulated rather nicely the sort of underlying dynamics of overload. So the description says dynamic work design emphasizes real-time adjustments over static planning in response to rapid environmental changes, akin to modern traffic apps. They use that as a really nice metaphor for adapting to real-time information. The article argues for moving from a push type of scheduling method to more of a pull type of methodology, in order to mitigate organizational overload caused by task switching, short-term fixes, and reduced capacity in response to variation. Then moving on to the fourth article, "When People Thrive, Business Thrives: The Case for Human Sustainability." Article came out of Deloitte. Dynamic work design emphasizes real-time adjustments over static planning, in response to rapid environmental changes. The article argues that organizations must prioritize human sustainability by creating value for all individuals connected to those organizations, including workers, contractors, customers, communities. The approach leads to better outcomes for both organizations and humanity. And the article really emphasizes the fact that for so long we've really focused on the good of the organization. And perhaps there's, well, and argues for the fact that there is a very definite need for us to switch to a greater interest in humanity. Human sustainability involves focusing on metrics that measure outcomes such as well-being, skills development, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Lots of those kind of words came up in particularly the last two articles. And finally, let's go on to the last article. This was an academic article, 32 pages long. "The Emerging Concept of the Human-Centered Organization," a review and synthesis of the literature. So not necessarily a new concept, but the article does quite nicely look to pull together some of the common threads, compared particularly two different approaches, what they called human-centered design and then the humanistic management approach. And it's research-based, obviously, and focused on, I think there were about 19 articles, if I remember correctly, but I may be wrong, and just looked at the emphases that the different schools of thought placed on what HCO actually means, and the implications. And then the article kind of, or the authors synthesized the different perspectives into an integrated framework, which is quite nicely presented in the article. And you'd obviously be able to go and have a look at that. So before I move on to question, have I left anything vital out before we get into the conversation? Okay, don't see any hands yet. So hopefully we're doing fine. And Tanya, as always, is going to put up the poll for us, or as often happens, she'll put up a poll. And the question we're wanting to answer in this first poll is, which of these articles really spoke to us? Did we find most meaningful or helpful? Which were the most useful articles? And if you quickly just pop your response into that. And then when
Like
everybody's
watching
responding.
horse races, as I see the, they jump back forth.
Always love your commentary on this one, Tanya.
We have a clear leader. This one's got
Ah.
a few lengths ahead, so let's share the results.
Okie dokes. So, clear leader, definitely. Your organization isn't designed to work with generative AI. Not too strong in the middle, too. And then the last article coming in quite strongly in second place, I guess. Cool. So I'm going to invite you all. I'm not going to pick on people. I'm just going to invite you, if you've read the articles, if you want to participate, if you haven't read the articles and you have a thought on what's being said, please feel free to just jump in. Maybe let's begin with people who did pick that first article, and invite somebody from that group to say why.
I might go real quick. I thought it was very compelling. The process and the example they gave was excellent. So it was just very, it was very well summarized concisely and persuasively.
Dara, did you make note of that process to just sort of share with anybody who didn't read the article?
Sorry. So the three core parts of it were task analysis, interaction protocols, and feedback loops. And reading the examples really brought it home, in a practical manner.
Yeah, I like that as well. I thought that was really, really useful. Anybody want to maybe expand on those three steps? Or comment on them?
Jim has his hand up.
Jim, sorry, yes, hand up. Go for it.
What struck me was the just the idea that you would take a current process and you would examine its tasks and you would ask the question, how can generative AI help with this task, eliminate this task, or help the person? As opposed to supposing you had a capability where leaders were listened to as they discussed and made decisions about things. And it could be taught how you do things today and where the weaknesses are, and had a conversation with it. So the idea is, don't start from what you've got. Start from what the output of what you've got is, and work backwards to say, supposing we had a capability of answering questions on the fly based on previous conversations and pre-made choices. So they took a very technical approach to what's an adaptive challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I found myself thinking the whole way through, you know, it almost feels like I'm designing for this person. You know, what is it that this person is going to bring to the table? And how does that capability shift what we can potentially do with the process or with a particular aspect of the work? I really, and I was consciously thinking that as I was reading. Who else?
What if we could use AI?
Mike.
Facilitator. In other words, that AI could listen in on the conversation and provide feedback to decision makers as to where their conversations are lacking or problems with the process itself that it's picking up and listening to the conversation. That'd be like having a professional facilitator in the room to facilitate better dialogue and perhaps better outcomes based on the decisions being made.
Mike, I think that's a lovely tidbit to throw into the circle. What does everybody think about that?
I have three people in one company who I coach and mentor, and they have introduced a seat for generative AI, a seat for Gemini in every meeting.
Yeah.
So they put Gemini on, and then afterwards they ask it to summarize the conversation. And they said at first they would have a 30-minute meeting and it would summarize it down to about 45 seconds. And then they got to the point where they could have an hour-long meeting and it would bring it down to about 25 minutes. And what they found was that old realization that 99% of what is discussed in meetings is lost. Yeah. And now 100% is captured. And they're learning how to work with it to make better decisions faster, to identify conflicts. Gemini can even pick out from individual voices who's in conflict with whom.
Wow. So I would, just to respond to that, and I'd love everybody else to also chip in. My immediate thought is, I wouldn't want that only at the end of the meeting. I would imagine it would become more useful if it was almost like if it happened at the midpoint or three quarters of the way through, so that there's a chance to respond. Did that happen, Jim?
I don't know the details of their experiments, but it's expanding to more and more groups who have been exposed to it, and they're having learning sessions around what did we learn from that? What was good? What was not so good? It doesn't seem to get what do you call it when you make a gross overstatement? It doesn't make a distinction between a statement of fact and a statement of speculation. So yeah. People have actually learned to rephrase things like in my opinion, to use in my opinion or in my experience, as opposed to this is just stating a fact. So there's a little behavior issues that are being addressed by the group. It's just fascinating to listen to them describe what's going on.
Amazing. Any other thoughts around AI as a facilitator?
Well, one of the roles of a facilitator, at least when I was doing that work within the oil company I work for, I found the use of minutes was very helpful in delegating responsibilities and having a feedback loop. Who was responsible for what to be delivered by when in terms of the follow-on actions to the meeting. And also capturing some of the rationales behind some of the decisions that were being made. So I wonder if AI could take on the role of scribe, for example, and take a lot of that work out of developing the minutes and from voice to text, take that burden off documenting decisions and meetings as well.
Yeah. Jadina.
Yes, I love what you said, Mike, because I think that people come out of a meeting with very different understandings of what just happened. So it'd be nice to have someone help. I just wanted to go back to Jim's comment earlier about solving for technical pro solving adaptive challenges with a technical solution, because I think that that was what bothered me about this article. When they talked in the middle here, really triggered me about the task analysis, breaking down tasks and evaluating them for if they should be allocated to AI or human. I think it's solving for like the known unknowns, but what AI can be really powerful about, kind of to Jim's point of what they're using it for, is the unknown unknowns, right? And I think that's the gap. When you look at this, it's like they're only solving for what they know needs to be solved.
Yeah. Very powerful insight, Jardine. Anybody want to add to that? Or contradict it? Even better, dissenting voice. Or maybe picking up on something that came out of one of the other articles, and I can't remember which, but there was a tiny little piece that I wrote down as kind of my thought for the day, which was about the absent voices. What voice is absent from this conversation?
I did notice that they talked about designing the process and then kind of training all the employees as opposed to involving the employees from the beginning.
Yeah. What might that look like, Dara?
I mean, basically from the very start, just giving everybody a voice. From a practical perspective, I guess you'd ask for volunteers to join, a group or maybe have a bunch of groups. I'm not really an org design person. I'm an imposter here, just here to learn.
I think we all are, aren't we, in some way?
Yeah, all
Cool.
imposters.
Oh, yeah.
Janet, maybe adding to that, it's making me think. So if you think about, when we're designing and we want to design with a lot of different stakeholder voices in the room, you could look at it to say, well, the AI might be able to give us different perspectives, by asking it what could be a different stakeholder voice. The danger of that could be that you exclude those stakeholders because you assume that the AI is going to represent them. What I like about this article is positioning it as designing for dialogue. So I'm thinking about, I don't know how you could do it, but how do you use the AI to actually bring more stakeholder perspectives in the room without being the fake stakeholder kind of thing?
Love that,
like
Julie.
I like that idea, and it sort of parallels what I was just thinking a minute or two ago about when you're designing for dialogue or deliberations, which is a series of meetings over time. I wonder if there's a way you could use AI to look at the attendee list and identify voices that are not on that list that should be, and perhaps designing the deliberation process in such a way as to engage the right people, the right knowledge at the right time.
The unknown unknowns, yeah.
The big challenge with that is, how does it learn it? How does it learn to do that? Because AI is highly prone to making things up.
I think, speaking of designing for dialogue, I think the article talks about the relationship between AI and humans, but I think to your point, Jim, I think with AI hallucinating a fair amount of time and making things up, I think it's teaching employees how to interact, how to talk about that together, and how to be more analytical, in this world of technology now, because I guess kind of talking about thinking about how AI listens to those conversations and will output or regurgitate everything from those meetings. It's to what I think somebody was saying, it was a Jardina earlier, about those, everybody comes out of that room with different perspectives. And I think what this helps us really think about, or like provokes these conversations of like, oh, I didn't realize this was happening in the meeting, but this is what the AI told me. So let me go talk to Jardina. Like, is that correct? Like, I think that's what's really great about AI in this situation, and for specific situation with AI, it's helping us, you know, do some of these more mundane tasks, but then also it also empowers us to talk to each other about like questioning the AI.
Yeah, I'd like to build on that idea because I think it's critical. There's a role for the human in this dialogue process to challenge AI's thinking and to ask things, for example, well, when you made this suggestion, what were your sources of information? In other words, to get into the thinking AI is presenting and checking the AI's thinking itself. So there's the part of this dialogue, it's a two-way street. So humans have to challenge the AI thinking process as well.
I'd like to build on that because I think there are at least a couple of different levels that I've seen AI function very effectively. One is, as you've already observed, capturing what's going on in a meeting, synthesizing it, and someone's already alluded to the fact that what you notice is what that sensitizes people to start phrasing things like, I think, or I heard that, rather than stating it as a fact. So that's the Hawthorne effect, which is when people are watched, they tend to perform better, you know, follow the rules better. I think that's a very powerful and useful use of AI. But I think that even more powerful is something that you all are touching on. And I think we need to be very careful not to treat AI as another sentient being that we can interrogate and actually have a dialogue with. We can kind of, but if you've done any of the research on AI prompts, you know that it's incredibly sensitive to exactly what you're saying to it. And what occurred to me is, wouldn't it be fabulous to have AI record some of our decision meetings, strategy decision-making meetings, just record them, synthesize them, and then 6 months or a year later, we come back and have a discussion about how those decisions played out and start giving the AI database some information that could actually help us improve our decisions. I think that could be incredibly powerful.
That makes me think, Rich, if we think about those three elements that were included in the article, it talked about feedback. And what you're suggesting, and what a couple of people have suggested, is that it is just as important for us to give feedback to the AI as it is for us to receive feedback from the AI, which is a very cool insight. Anybody else?
Well, it's also, there's two things. One is there's the human, there's the AI, and there's what the two together create. So there's almost like three dimensions to look at it. It's just a thought that I haven't thought through, but what does that two together look like? And how do you address that?
Nice. Sarah, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just enjoying the conversation as well. So I was kind of happy listening. I think there's a couple of things that are just going on in my mind. One of them is around, you know, using AI to kind of document stuff and the confidentiality around this. And I think obviously if you're using something like ChatGTP, it's out in the ether. So I think if you're certainly using, you know, your own organizational data or client data, there are a lot of sensitivities around how you use that. And I think that's just something to be conscious of. You know, I know there are obviously people may have their own AI tools, but I think sensitivity of, you know, commercial data is something that you know, in all our experimentation, I think we need to be a little bit conscious of. The other thing I was quite interested in, you know, that we're talking about in the, well, two other things is one, the unreliability of AI and its, you know, creating things which aren't true, which is humans, as we know, are just as capable of doing that. So I think the whole testing and interrogation thing, we have to be, you know, mindful of that. But the point that Jardina made about, you know, the unknown unknowns, I think what I'm curious about is to what extent does AI, is AI able to create and to imagine and to generate? So this whole thing around, you know, creativity, and clearly, you know, it is able to, you know, generate things that we would normally think to be in the, you know, something like imagination, we think it was a very human thing, and yet it is able to create and imagine. And so I've been curious about using AI in terms of generating scenarios in our work, because, you know, sometimes when we're working in the type of work we're doing, and, you know, particularly kind of strategic, you're often wanting to generate scenarios. And I think it's a very quick and easy way to generate, you know, mm-hmm. fictional scenarios, but which can be quite powerful. So for me, that feels quite a safe but easy way to incorporate AI, you know, in organization design work. It's a simple thing. You know, it's not a very advanced way of using AI, but I think to me that feels one way it can be used to help our thinking and to press into that, because it very quickly can kind of put a different spin on things, if you know, as you interrogate it.
Lovely, thank you. I wanted to add two thoughts in, and we can start thinking about looking at the next poll just now, Tanya. One thing is that we've been taught to prompt AI to help it think better. But I think we also need to think about how AI can help us to think better. So not just to give us answers, but, you know, we can ask AI to give us, ChatGPT to give us 20 questions to explore. And I think that as facilitators, that is a really useful potential tool. You know, what, and it ties in a little bit with what Jardina was saying is, you know, what are those things we haven't thought to ask? What are those questions we haven't considered? And then maybe one other thing just to chuck in that maybe hasn't come up in the conversation is the challenge of overwhelm, because it can generate so much information so quickly. You know, that our, in part, our human limitations means we don't have to think about quite so many alternatives, quite so many variables. When AI can check out 60 topics for me in less than 2 minutes on a particular subject, that gives me way too much to think about. And I think that that's also just something we as facilitators potentially in these kind of conversations have to be able to manage.
You know, and it's other than the wealth of data as well, one of the things we could query AI to do is to discern patterns within the data and use it to get there. Since it seems to be one of the strengths to be able to look at enormous amounts of data and distill it to patterns that might be helpful to inform the decisions we're pursuing or the course of action we're exploring.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mike. Any last thoughts? Or maybe, as we've been having this conversation, anybody been using AI for something really exciting? Just to chuck in a couple of good ideas, and maybe not to be elaborated upon, but anything, any last thoughts?
Something exciting to me is I write programs that read digital books and transform them so that when the text is converted to speech, blind people can understand what's going on.
Oh, wow.
And I had a conversation with Gemini. I asked it to read the book Where the Crawdads Sing.
Yeah.
And to identify content in the book that would not trans would not translate well to phonetic description. And it taught me not to use the word phonetic description. It helped me figure out what the proper phrasing for my question was. And it went through and it highlighted 90 places in the book where there were vertical arrows, there were triple quotation marks, there were triple or double exclamation points. And it highlighted that those are places where the reader would hear question mark, question mark, question mark, and then they wouldn't know how to discern what was going on. So I wrote the code to eliminate those from the book, and eventually it got to the point where it couldn't come back with any complaints. And we sent it off for testing to one of the institutes for the deaf, and they came back and they gave it a perfect 100-point score. So Gemini and I are working much better together for any book that I can get it to read and to give us the information.
Stunning. What a lovely idea. Amazing. Anybody else? Last thoughts? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, done. Tanya, can we bring up the other poll? So here we want to look at which was the article that for us caused most tension. So maybe you really didn't like it, or maybe there was some ambivalence going on inside of you.
It was 35 pages long, count for tension.
Yeah, that, two of them.
No, I'm eliminating that one as an outlier.
And we've got three running neck and neck, four running neck and neck.
Oh, make my life difficult.
Bit of a leader now. All right, half of you have voted. I'll give it another moment. All right, and here's your results.
There we go. Okay, as Tanya says, clear leader. Interesting that the last one didn't attract a single comment. Maybe that was because 35 pages was too much to go through. So how dynamic work design can prevent overload? And I'm really intrigued to hear what was the tension. Anybody who selected that article, maybe get the ball rolling for us. Somebody must have picked the article.
Okay, I will.
Thanks.
And I know, I bet you that Jim is on the same page with me on this, but I'm going to just see what happens. I mean, there's nothing bad about this article, except for that it's 60-year-old ideas from Toyota Production Systems, and it's acting like he just thought of it. That's what bothered me. But I think that the real question that he doesn't answer, that we can maybe talk about, hopefully, is like what needs to change in the design of the organization for the organization to embrace pull over push? Because that's where it's hard. Everyone knows the physics about pull versus push. We've proven that a million times. But the question is, why don't people want to do it? So, and what metric can we use? Yeah.
Do you want to get the ball rolling with a thought?
A first
response to the question, or should we plug it into ChatGPT?
There you go.
Jardina, any immediate thoughts?
Oh, in terms of metrics and how to design for it?
Answering one question.
Well, I want to give away. I want to hear whatever, but I'll just tell you the one that I use that I think is super powerful is measuring the holding cost of work in progress against the value delivered and trying to shrink that ratio. But like no one does that. But then it's tying it to dollars, your actual dollars and ROI, not just saying like, it's better. Flow is better, right? Which no one understands.
Stunning, Jardina.
Yeah, I think Linens and Things learned that. Oh, yeah, they went out of business, didn't they? But there's a couple of concepts that we worked into our organization design practices was to understand the rate of change and to design for rate of change. So if your organization is changing dynamically at the rate of maybe, let's say, once every 3 years, and it takes you a year to implement an ERP system, did you just cripple your company by making a gigantic investment in technology? Another one is the likelihood of disruption and the origins of disruption. So what could disrupt you and how can you avoid that? That came up in a cruise line. So what disrupts cruise lines? Usually it's weather, but geopolitical issues also come in. And so doing a canvas of various sources of disruption and then building resiliency against those disruptions had increased their revenues dramatically by just repositioning ships. And the last one was, what is the useful life of design? So this organization design can be implemented in 6 months and it has a useful life of 2 years. So let's not slow down the implementation process with over designing it. Let's just get after it. So those are a lot of thoughts that came out, and I totally agree with Jordana. There's nothing really new there. It's just labeling and packaging. But the practice of organization design doesn't really seem to focus at all on resiliency and adaptability. It's all about a new stasis. Everything's going to be fine after we get through with all this change, because everything's going to be like that for a long time. And it's not. And then at the same time, because it's not, that's what puts the resistance on the map for the next change, because you lied to me last time saying it was going to be better. It's just different.
So I'm very conscious that Julie's got her hand up, but just what I thought about as you were speaking, Jim, was, you know, you're building in resilience for the what ifs, for those potential disruptions. But I'm certain, and I think we probably all had the same thought, that building those resiliences in had impact even if the disruptions never happened. Because you were building substance into the organization, which is amazing. Julie?
Do you mean me, Janet?
Yes. Sorry, Jody.
So it's okay. There's multiple parties on the call. There's usually lots of us. Jardina, you were asking, what do you think are the barriers that stop us from moving to that pool? And what I notice with companies that I'm working with is they often tell me, oh, we're really good at firefighting, but we're not so good at creating, you know, more effective ways of working. And I feel like that's one of the big barriers that I encounter, is that they're so good at firefighting and so proud, and people, there's certain kind of hero types of people in the organization who are just great at navigating around the system. And some companies even say, they even have a recruiting strategy that says, we look for people who can work, you know, outside of the systems. So I find this, so I find, exactly, it's like, well, how about you change the system and then you don't need to recruit those people. So I think one of the things that, you know, we're often aiming for with the design changes is, you know, trying to separate out those roles. Like, you do have to have people who handle those exceptions, but you also need to have people who can focus on strategy and system change, so that you try and match the roles to the skills, kind of thing.
Lovely.
Yeah, totally. I just want my hand up to respond to Jody. I love the, there's a couple of phrases I've been hearing lately about firefighting. So I think that's a thing to talk about, because when you use a pulse system, firefighting is a less of a problem. But I love when the quote that when you reward firefighters, you grow a culture of arsonists or something like that, right? And someone I was just talking to a client the other day that said, we have too many firefighters and not enough fire marshals, right? That we're not creating the process. But I think the thing about that I ask those folks that always complain about the firefighting is, what makes that a problem? Like, because if you use a pulse system, firefighting is okay, right? It's not always, it's a problem because everything is so rigidly planned. That's a lot of times why it's a problem. Like sometimes firefighting is being responsive, and sometimes it's BS, right? By the way,
yeah,
you have to make the distinction.
It goes to the duality of problems themselves, and that there's an immediate fix to address the symptoms of the problem so that the outcome gets back within a range of variation. But there's also the underlying issue. What's the root cause of this problem? I remember when I was working at the Chicago Transit Authority, and we raised the fares from 75 cents to a dollar. Well, our entire fare collection system was based upon coins. Well, as soon as the dollars, everybody started paying with dollars, and the fare collection had no security at all because the whole system was compromised. But we really didn't get to the heart of the problem until we changed the technology to accept dollar bills as well. So, and there was enormous amounts of loss in terms of theft, a lot of disruption to operations until we got to the real underlying root cause of the problem.
Rich, you might be able to help me with this, I suspect. There's a methodology that I read about extensively several years ago, and this is my weakness. I tend to collect ideas. I don't always remember where they came from, and I don't always remember what they were called. But it was basically, it was looking at the idea, and it was particularly being exercised in the healthcare sector, where they were really looking at how do we deal with problems in a much more effective way. So you know that how often we kind of encounter situations and we're putting out the fire, and we have a workaround because that's the quick, simple way to just resolve the issue now so that we can get stuff done. And this particular approach looked at, had a problem, effectively a dedicated problem solving team. So every time you encountered an issue, you had to call the dedicated problem solving team to make sure that they actually figured out the real solution to the problem. So you were allowed to have a workaround for that instance, but they had to go and work to solve problems. And I'm not going to go into the detail. There's the most beautiful example of how they applied this in a hospital environment and dramatically reduced wastage in terms of their outpatient department. And they put some very cool things into the system that nobody would ever have thought of, because they would have expected that those mechanisms were actually inefficient. And they turned out to be extremely efficient. And they were very, very human-centric. And I don't know, Rich, do you know what it's called?
Was that a question?
Yeah.
That was a long question. So you bring to mind any number of methods that grew out of systems thinking in the 80s and 90s. And one of the ones that Sally Parker and I are working on, Polarity, we're working in an organization where the problems they're facing typically are when a pension system is stuck in one polarity. And we're trying to help them see that in some cases, it's not solving a problem. It's recognizing that you're in a natural cycle and you need to balance that cycle. The other thing, though, that I found very effective with the engineering groups I worked with, and healthcare has some of the same kind of rigid thinking in terms of administration, but was systems diagrams. And just leading a group through, this happens, okay, what happens next? Why does that happen? And slowly you're basically educating a group of people that are having a problem as to, oh my God, I didn't realize, you know, when the butterfly flapped his wings, it caused a hurricane in China.
Yeah.
There's some interesting cases that were written up about the United Kingdom's healthcare system where they had what they call an incident review. So if a patient came in with a hangnail and died in the emergency room, that would go into review. But if a patient came in with a hangnail and they took some measures against the hangnail and they gave them, you know, medications to take on the way home and whatnot, and 4 weeks later, that patient was brought in sepsis. The connection between the hangnail treatment and the infection that caused the sepsis would never have been caught for review.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody came in and did a study and found that 15% of patients who came into the emergency room with an open wound returned to the hospital with an infection within 18 weeks, they started to connect the dots and said, we need to start treating medicine holistically, not incidentally. And there was a good deal of write-ups on that in the 90s and right through the 2000s. Then they're still working on the methodology, but most hospitals also examine both the short-term, the once in and never back, and they engage, because it's one insurance provider, they have access to the medical records, whether the patient went to the same unit or a different unit for treatment. So they get much better data in the UK than the US did, but they never used it.
I just want to check something in here that's also, and it kind of almost maybe relates back to our previous conversation. I worked in a medical aid company. It's a South African term, so medical insurance. And we had a very unique approach to managing claims. What would happen in what happens in most companies is it's literally, you know, that's the amount of money, that's the rule, pay the money. Well, don't pay the money, whichever way around it works. But we actually, this company employed nurses who used to go on site, read the invoice from the doctor and actually engage intelligently with the individual patient. We had the lowest rate of increase across the entire industry, and we were one of the smallest companies because we were using people to actually interpret the data, who were trained. And so, yeah, it's just, I guess it's just a reminder that we have to be careful of what we're doing and how we're interpreting things. Any other
circling back to the earlier, that earlier discussion we had, there are already chat bots that can be used by people who are in depression or crisis, and they're not as good as a therapist, but they're better than nothing. And how long will it be before our technology gets to a point where you won't know whether you're talking to a real person or a chat bot? You're still trying to find out what the customer thinks, which seems, so I agree with you. It's the human intervention, but I think we need to look even deeper than that. Yes, it's the human intervention, but it's actually treating the customer as a human with needs and wants that you need to satisfy.
Yeah, absolutely. Any last responses to Jadida's question? How do we promote Paul? While you're thinking, I'm just going to quickly zap to the chat. So there's a lot of conversation, a lot of thoughts in the chat. Dara, I found this comment interesting. I'm working on positive, purpose-driven companies and how to humanize work. maybe just give us some thoughts around that quickly before we wrap up.
Yeah, sure. So I have a new client, which is kind of too good to be true. They're doing a pivot right now. They make software and they're building software to try and allow big companies to operate like startups. And they're very focused on only, they want me to find only purpose-driven companies having a positive impact on the world. They have me studying and reading books about humanocracy, human organized design, sociocracy. Like they're genuinely 100% purpose-driven, and they're trying to build software to enable this movement to, I guess, happen more quickly. So
that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lovely topic for a long conversation.
Yeah, I would love to talk to anyone who's interested in that right now, because I'm just the learning stage. And yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic purpose and company if they can make it happen.
Oh, amazing.
A couple of references. You likely follow Dave Ulrich, the RBL group in University of Michigan. Dave Ulrich's new bent is on human contribution, human involvement, and whatnot. And when I was a partner with Dave, a couple of our clients wanted to go very deeply into that. And we explained to them that it starts with recruitment and hiring. If you want to transform a large organization into a human-centered organization, you have a 30-year challenge ahead of you, because you have to wait for people to leave the company and be replaced by different individuals. And the other side is that there aren't people and there aren't employees. There are individuals who have the roles of employees. So it's the generalization that seems to cause the problem with not being able to get to a more human-centered. So think, if you would, of an organization. Zappos is a good one to look at, Zappos. From the moment that of recruitment until you leave the organization, you are one culture. And they want you to be part of that culture before you even know what it is. So the hiring process screens for people who will fit the culture of Zappos.
Yeah.
So it's easy to be human-centric when all the humans are centered. I did work for the Church of Latter-day Saints. Same case. Shared mindset over what the values and principles of operation and work and whatnot. It is a people-centered organization or a human-centered organization. I did similar work with the Daughters of Charity, and it's the exact opposite.
Sure.
They only share religious beliefs. They don't share behavioral beliefs. Fascinating stuff.
I was reminded as I was reading through the articles, we read an article, sure, must be almost 3 years ago, I think, that talked about core values potentially being replaced or made more subservient to core beliefs. Which was a really, really interesting article. I was reminded of that today. So we're going to have to wrap up, unfortunately. But for those who haven't noticed in the chat, Tanya did just pop in the link to book for the community conversation next Thursday, which really does potentially speak into what we've just wrapped up with right now at the end, with Dara bringing that into the conversation. So for those of you interested in that, maybe join that conversation. And Tanya, I'm going to hand over to you to do your usual brilliant wrap-up.
Well, thank you, Janet. Really appreciate you making the time to be organized and do your overview of the articles and then help facilitate this conversation. It's much appreciated. And I don't know, anything extra going on? Jardina said next week she's doing a talk on soulful orgs. So she can't make the community conversation, but she's also doing that same or a similar version of that same material at our conference coming up. in May 7th to 9th in Minnesota. So it looks like a handful of folks that are on this call will probably be joining us. If you are more interested in just an introduction to OD, we do have a one-day pre-con workshop that is led by one of our board members, Cynthia Escamilla. That's an offering. And we're also going to be talking about EODF has their next master class being planned in June, I believe is when it's going to get started. And they're scheduling it on US-based time zones instead of their usual UK-based. So it'll be a little bit earlier in the day if folks have an interest. So we'll be sharing some information about that. So I am going to stay on the line if anybody has any questions that I can help answer. In other words, thank you so much, Janet, for being here and for the rest of you for joining and contributing your genius. It, I'm sure, helps the folks that are able to jump in here. And I just love that you all are so open to sharing.
Just one last comment that's in the chat, Jody. Keep getting your name wrong today, Jody. Jody has asked whether anybody else is interested in the conversation around sustainability. And if you are, maybe that's something that could be picked up later, or maybe some of us can get together for a chat. I'm really interested in that subject as well.
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, somebody designed something to bring it up as a, whether it's a coffee club or topic or a community conversation with a little bit more of a structured sense. We're starting to build our summer schedule. And so reach out and let me know. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.